Welcome to Talking History in our special Christmas show. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to Lee Eric Schmidt about the history of the consumerism of Christmas. We'll also be giving you a Christmas quiz, so get out your pencil and paper. But before we do that, let's look back at a major event this week in history. On December 27th, 1831, Charles Darwin set sail aboard the HMS Beagle on a voyage that would revolutionize mankind's thinking about its origins. Darwin, an English naturalist, sailed to South America and into the Pacific, where he gathered information on the varieties of life in the plant and animal kingdoms. From that information, when he considered how such varieties might have come about, Darwin formulated his theory of evolution, which he published in On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection in 1841, one of the best known and most controversial books of all time. Turning to this week's history in the news, Muslim Turks have a bone to pick with the Italians over the lost relics of St. Nicholas. In fact, if Turkey's Santa Claus Foundation has its way, his bones will be turned out of their grave once again. The citizens' group is demanding that a Catholic church in Bari, Italy, return St. Nicholas' bones to his old church in ancient Myra, now Demra, a town on Turkey's Mediterranean coast. The group claims the bones were stolen in 1087 by merchants from Bari and reinterred by that city's church. It might be difficult for the people of Bari to be separated from the relics, the foundation conceded in a letter to the archbishop, but they will feel relieved for rectifying an ancient error. You're listening to Talking History.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. Is the night of the dear Savior's birth.
Well, Christmas is just around the corner, and as you rush from store to store, completing, perhaps starting, your Christmas shopping, you're probably having your second annual thoughts, which so many Christians share, on the consumerism that has come to symbolize Christmas as much as the manger. When did such consumerism come to permeate the Christmas celebration? Was it only in the last few years or generation, as many suggest, or do its roots go deeper into the soil of history? Here to help us better understand the origins of Christmas as we now celebrate it is Lee Eric Schmidt, Professor of Religion at Princeton University. Professor Schmidt's specialty is American religious history, and among his many publications is his very highly regarded book, Consumer Rights, that's R-I-T-E-S, The Buying and Selling of American Holidays, published by Princeton University Press. Welcome, Professor Schmidt, and thank you for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Good to talk with you.
Let's jump right in. Is this consumerism that we condemn every Christmas new to our American celebration? As many people suggest, I usually hear, well, it wasn't like that when we were a kid.
Well, no, it's not new at all, actually. There's been these kinds of laments in the culture for more than a century now, almost ritualized lament about the sordid bargaining spirit that's permeated Christmas. And in fact, people were already complaining in the 1880s about how the stores were always getting an earlier jump on the Christmas season, moving it back to Thanksgiving and so on. So we've had these kinds of complaints for a while, for at least a century and even a century and a half.
Do the origins of consumerism tie in or coincide with the origins of the modern American Christmas as we identify it today?
They're certainly connected. A big part of this modern Christmas was its place in the stores, and another important part of the modern Christmas is its place in the home, and the two very much went together. The stores providing the gifts and the things to celebrate with in the home. So as Christmas becomes much more of a home-centered, family-centered celebration, which is really one of the defining qualities of this modern Christmas, it also then works much better in the stores. So the two do go together, and they really reach a maturity by the middle decades of the 19th century and then continue to grow after that.
That's interesting, too, that we don't ordinarily consider together. Consumerism and domesticity both are at the root of the modern Christmas?
That's right. They're synergistic, and one plays off the other. And it's also true that the more important that Christmas became in the churches, but that also gave it more of a place in the stores, more symbols for the stores to play off of. Originally, many Protestants, especially in the Puritan mold, had resisted Christmas and hadn't celebrated it. And so it took a while for many of these Protestants to come back around and start imbuing the celebration with religious meanings again. And as they are drawn again to these sacral meanings in Christmas, as they're doing more and more in their churches, well, that in turn creates more opportunities for stores to play off of that religious significance as well. So you've got three things intertwined here. You've got the homes, the churches, and the stores all playing off one another.
Let me bring you back to that reference to the Puritans earlier. H.L. Mencken said, and I'm paraphrasing now, that the definition of a Puritan was someone that thought that someone somewhere was having a good time. Is this just simply a matter of not wanting to have a good time? Why were the Puritans so opposed to the celebration of Christmas?
Well, it is partly a concern about excessive festivity, just that the kind of excess in that, of people drinking too much and forgetting their devotions, their prayers, their kind of the worship in the families and so on. So there is a that side of it. But there's a deeper polemic here as well, that they consider these celebrations Catholic, and so much of the Puritan rhetoric is formed by its anti-Catholicism. And so these celebrations, the Advent Christmas cycle, and in turn the Lent, Holy Week, Easter cycle, are seen as being part and parcel of Catholic liturgical traditions. And Puritans really believed in a much leveler version of holy time, focused on Sabbath observances, week-to-week Sabbath observances, and not on these big festal events, which they associated with Catholicism and secondarily with Anglicanism, from which they were dissenting.
How would we expect, if we were to be transported in time outside of Puritan New England, how would we expect Christmas to have been celebrated before it was reinvented in the 19th century?
Well, there would have been a few ways. There's certainly some Protestant folks, and of course in early America, most of the churchgoers were Protestants. There were some Catholics in Maryland, but it was a fairly Protestant, dominantly Protestant milieu. And some of those people would have celebrated Christmas. There would have been religious celebrations, including Lutherans and Moravians and the Anglicans. So there would have been a devotional side to this. But always more prominent, really, would have been the popular forms of this, the drinking, the eating, the masking and kind of dressing up and costuming associated with these kind of carnival traditions, popular carnival traditions. More of that would have been in evidence and on display than the devotional sides. Most religious folks, most Anglicans, Lutherans, and so on, despaired about really holding on to the religious meanings of the celebration when it will, really seeing these popular folk forms of celebrating as the forms that had the upper hand, that would have been much more common. Lots of drinking, lots of eating, just that kind of intense excess of celebration.
And that's what led really to its reinvention in the 19th century, sort of despaired over that popular type of celebrating?
Right. That was one of the main things that concerned reformers who were trying to come up with new ways of celebrating. They wanted to get away from those carnival forms and all that went with that, so that they hoped to come up with ways of having these holidays that meshed better with middle-class domestic sensibilities, rituals that worked well in the home, that didn't have people parading out in the streets, shooting off guns, drinking a lot in the taverns, and so on. So that was a big part of create the right kind of home celebration that could offer a counterweight to these popular, rowdy street forms of celebrating.
What role did Irving and Dickens and Moore and the others play in this reinvention?
Well, certainly these literary figures had an important role. I think sometimes we exaggerate that. We try to come up with a few figures, say Dickens' Christmas Carol or Clement Clark Moore's Twas a Night Before Christmas, that famous poem, and give them the lion's share of credit for the reinvention of Christmas. It's true that their texts were very important, but they're part of a wider cultural milieu in which there are lots of other poems and stories beginning to circulate in middle-class periodicals about the Christmas holidays. And so these kinds of Christmas stories, these kinds of Christmas poems were important. A few in the longer term stood out very much above the rest. But at the time, you know, a friend of, say, Washington Irving, like James Paulding, who wrote a book of St. Nicholas, he was as likely to be influential in reinventing the holiday as, say, these figures we now still read.
Mm-hmm. How does this, then, let me bring you back to the point you made earlier. This creates what I would call a Victorian Christmas. How does this connect with what you mentioned in your book, The Birth of the Christmas Market in Consumerism?
Right, right. I was interested there in giving some sense of how that market emerged, of really locating it in different institutions. But initially, the Christmas market is really focused on providing the kinds of goods that you need for that carnival kind of celebration. Lots of food, lots of drink, very kind to tavern keepers and so on. Out of that market, you start to get other kinds of shopkeepers who have important goods, you know, toy shops. Also, there's a big entertainment market at the holidays. People have a little more time at that season of the year, so you have the museums, the popular museums, the kind of Barnum-like museums are putting on holiday entertainment for very extravagant and drawing a lot of people in. So I wanted to look at the multiple commercial institutions that are really responsible for building up this market from a much more limited one in the colonial period that focused, you know, pretty conventional ways on tavern keepers and innkeepers and those kinds of things.
When you mention shopkeepers, you're not just talking about the small business owner on the corner. We're now getting into the temple of consumerism here, the department store. How did this play in at this point?
Actually, you begin to get in these urban centers, especially larger and larger stores, you start getting these dry goods stores that are moving into ever more expansive goods. They have much more variety in their stores, and they become bigger and bigger, from being small shops to being these palatial urban emporiums. So you get these giant stores like R.H. Macy's. It takes off in the 1850s and 60s. John Wanamaker's department store empire in Philadelphia and also in New York, just exploding in size in the 1870s and 1880s and into the 20s, early 20th century. And any number of other big department store magnates like that. And they become crucial for dramatizing this new Christmas, for creating the kinds of spectacles that we associate with modern Christmas. The mall-like spectacles in it now are just part of the season. These department stores really work out that spectacle of a display at the holidays. And they're truly grand. I mean, the kinds of things that Wanamaker puts on or Macy's puts on, all of the attention to the window displays, these giant seasonal window displays that people lined up for 4 and 5 deep to look at, to see the new windows. And the same things were going on in the interiors of stores as well. Just mammoth displays. Many of these were built with open courts so you could have multi-story displays as you walked into these department stores, just engulfing displays of seasonal emblems, but also religious emblems could go up in the stores as well.
Well, that's an important point, because I used the term temple of consumerism earlier on purpose, although I don't recall you specifically saying it in your book. I did get a sense that people were almost going there to worship.
Right. And some of the best sources I had on that actually were John Wanamaker stories, because so there you have a really fine archive. And some of the people wrote letters in thanking him for turning his store into a shrine or worship space. He had little hymnals that he printed up from the 1910s and 20s, and actually that continued after his death right into the 1950s. Little hymnals that people would gather, thousands of people in the court, the grand court of the store in Philadelphia, and sing these Christmas hymns together. I mean, really the religious hymns, not just seasonal selections. And there was a giant organ, so he was giving this kind of church ambiance. They have this massive organ. At the time, the largest organ in the world was in Long Acre Store in about 1920. And so they created real church environments, and people were grateful for the kind of religious experience they had there. One man talked about his heart being strangely warmed, which is an old Wesleyan phrase for a kind of a conversion, a sense of really being moved spiritually. And he talked about his experience in the department store in those terms. So there was a deep religious ambiance created in these stores, however cynical we might want to be about that. Nonetheless, it was working in that way, almost like a shrine or a temple or a cathedral.
And what about the parades that we watch at Thanksgiving but always see Santa Claus bringing up the rear? What is this all about in terms of the Christmas season?
The department stores became major sponsors of those kinds of street parades. Actually, by the 1880s and 90s, there are already examples of this. And the Macy's Parade is from the 1920s. And there, it's an interesting thing that they're doing. I mean, they're kind of taking the old carnival traditions of street parades and costuming, and they're turning them into a commercial spectacle. So there's an absorption of the older carnival tradition into the market. There you've got a conflation of the holiday traditions. You're using Thanksgiving then to give this kind of festive kickoff to the Christmas season. And it, for Christians, I mean, there's a divorcing then of the Christmas season from Advent, and it's relocated in kind of American civic time. Thanksgiving's the kickoff, not the first Sunday of Advent. So those parades are very significant, I think, for kind of remaking the textures, qualities of American time.
You've studied this. You've written about it. Does it bother you? Is Christmas just too commercial?
I don't think you would have written this kind of book if you weren't deeply concerned about these issues. They didn't grip you in a certain way, that you thought these were issues that mattered profoundly. That is how people celebrate. What are the possibilities for celebrating? What are the possibilities, in this case, in this particular book, for Christian celebration in this culture? And I think that's a very important question. What kinds of rituals we have, what kind of holiday traditions we have, what our range of possibilities are, how we're constrained by the market, what kinds of ways Christianity gets reworked in a consumerist image in that marketplace. I think that's a very important question. A lot of critics have taken that on over a century, these kinds of sense of Christianity's real identification with the poor and the indigent being compromised by the ways in which it's celebrated so spectacularly in the marketplace. I'm drawn into those kinds of questions and concerns. I think I came in to this work with those questions at the front of my research. And as I worked through it, I think I came to appreciate some of the other side on this, some of the riches of these traditions that were created in people's homes and in the stores, with the help of the stores. And maybe it took away a little bit of the prophetic edge to the book. But nonetheless, those questions lingered for me and pulled me in. And I hope that I've written a kind of account that allows people with those sorts of critical perspectives to engage the holidays on those kinds of terms.
Well, I think you have. It's a good book. I recommend it to our listeners. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
I appreciate it. It's great to talk with you.
And Merry Christmas.
You too.
You've been listening to Lee Eric Schmidt, author of Consumer Rights, The Buying and Selling of American Holidays.
On the second day of Christmas, my true love sent to me two turtle doves in a pear tree. On the third day of Christmas, my true love sent to me.
For this special Christmas show, we have a quiz for you. The quiz consists of 10 questions just to see how much you really know about Christmas. We'll give you the answers later in the show. Pencils ready? Number 1. Literally, what does Christmas mean? 2, what was frankincense used for? 3, on the 11th day of Christmas, what, according to the song you just heard, did my true love bring to me? 4, what were mince pies originally made to symbolize? 5, which Christmas song became the biggest selling pop hit of all time? 6, when was Christmas first observed? 7, most traditional American Christmas foods have their origins in Europe. What is one exception? 8, who wrote the letter that brought about the equally famous response, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. We're looking for a last name there. And 9 and 10, to which newspaper did Virginia send her letter and in what year? While you're recording your answers to our quiz, here's a reading of both Virginia's letter and its famous response.
Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Signed, Virginia O'Hanlon.
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would the world be if there was no Santa Claus? It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith, then no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on a lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they're not there. Nobody can convince or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, or even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside the curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, all in this world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God he lives and lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the hearts of childhood.
Welcome back, and now the answers to our quiz. Let's see how you did. First, Christmas means Christ's Mass. 2, frankincense was used for embalming in the ancient world. On the 11th day of Christmas, my true love brought to me 11 pipers piping. Mince pies originally symbolized the manger. The biggest selling Christmas pop hit of all time is Irving Berlin's White Christmas, recorded by Bing Crosby in 1942. Christmas was first observed in the 4th century. The one truly American food consumed at traditional Christmas meals is the cranberry. And the answers to questions 8, 9, and 10 all related to the Dear Virginia letter. The young author of the original letters was, as you heard, Virginia O. Hanlon, and she mailed it to the New York Sun in 1897. I'd say that if you got half of those right, you pass. But pass or fail, I hope you've enjoyed our special Christmas show. Please join us next week for our New Year's program. We'll be discussing the history of bourbon whiskey, a venerable American drink consumed on many a New Year's Eve. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the land, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in the winter wonderland.